to the Diary 101 podcast. I am your host, Aka Kandela Kandepwe, also known as Aka. I am excited and a little nervous about this conversation, which is very rare. But today's guest is somebody I admire from afar, have met, and he talks about the stuff I would like to really go in depth about, and it's always about the mindset shift. The youths in Africa, he interacts with them a lot. And when I met him, we called him the parent that you're going to end. He's going to say no. That parent you're scared of in an African household? Yes, this is the parent I have here. And with no further delay, I'd like to welcome our guest today, Derek. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Aka Kandela. I hope you're well.
I'm well. How are you? I missed you so much.
No, it's always a pleasure to reconnect, right? It's always a pleasure to reconnect because reconnecting with people just, feeds the network, feeds the person that you are, because a network really is something that spurs you on. So, yeah, it's quite important.
On reconnecting, you interact with, I would say, over 1,000 young people every year in different capacities. How, because I didn't think you would remember, I don't even know if you still remember me, but maybe you do. I didn't think you would remember me. So it's how I always have to say, hey, hi, it's Aka Kandela, I'm an alumni. It's a whole speech I have to give. And I'm like, how do you keep up with all of us?
Look, in terms of the work that I do, and I mean, it's just been a full trajectory of my life, to be honest. There is no method to it. It's about those that present themselves and raise their hands. Because I think that in the work that we do, which I think it's really what my life is about, it's about celebrating others and enabling others. So it's always fulfilling when you see somebody raise their hand and they are saying, you know, I'm a green field, you know, and I'm ready to experiment with possibilities. That is always fulfilling because there's so much untapped potential out there.
That's interesting, and that's a very interesting way to look at it. You're my fourth guest from our Yali network, and I have started this series. I think I'll just start a series for Yali as well. So I started this series with
please do. There's a lot of amazing people out there.
Yeah, and I think I'm thinking that's the way I would keep the network somehow, and hoping other Yali alumni listen to the conversations and go like, I have met Derek. It's so good to get some wisdom out of him. He's such a busy man and I can't always have access to him. So him being on a podcast where I can listen to him for an hour, give us wisdom, and I hope it inspires them to reach out to their other networks amongst the Yali community and just start the conversation. So, I will. You're right. I should really start a Yali. So I already have 4 episodes. I will start a Yali series so that a few people, all of us can gather and listen and laugh and always say, oh, we really did have a good time in South Africa. And the other chapters too can say, it's really fun to know that there are chapters out there getting inspired like the rest of us. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I think let's have a conversation about that.
Yes, we should have a conversation about it.
How do we enable it? How to, because obviously you've got sight to, the group that you're exposed to, but we've got a broader sight, right? So we see 14 countries, we've seen just over 60 cohorts. So that's a diverse group. There's amazing people out there. So beyond what you have seen, so
Yes.
maybe let's create an opportunity for you to be able to access that network, and get to see amazing people.
I am definitely having this conversation. Makes me very
Yeah.
excited. I love it. One thing I was explaining before we started was I'm an introvert, right? But I'm also I have extroverted traits, right? So that means when I can be in a group of people and thrive at the moment, I have one-on-one conversations like this and get a real story out of it and have a real conversation. I think I'm leaning more into working with a few people.
There's a lot more exciting people that, and I
Yeah.
mean, interestingly, I'm actually an introvert as well.
I actually know you're an introvert. We
Yeah.
can spot you. You run away after giving a whole speech. We know you. So you were saying you're an introvert?
Yes, but and I think. And that's why I'm saying that, I mean, leadership development. I started my life as a teacher, so leadership development has just been, and I've actually run away from it at some point, and I was in corporate HR, and even in that space, as a generalist, it gives you an opportunity to do a whole lot more. There's a variety of functional areas in HR. It's recruitment, it's performance management, and it's all of that. But I think where I've made the biggest impact has been from a training and development perspective. I have made, I remember I worked for one other business, and I asked some people to resign from their work, to resign from their jobs. And I said, I'll give you 1 year to sell your car and your wife and all of that kind of stuff. Crazy things. And some people have, followed what was like a pipe dream at the time. And fast forward, people called me. I remember the one guy calling me at night, and he was having fun somewhere. And he called me just to tell me that, he never looks for a job anymore, and that opportunities chase after him. And I was like, wow, and when
Sounds
and yeah, I mean, when he
fun.
resigned, I said to him, I cannot give you any guarantee. And he was not the only one. I can count up to 10 people that had to do stupid things because of me.
There's something I've been thinking about of late is I'm an accounting graduate, right? I recently graduated when I was in South Africa.
Yes.
So
You studied
I'm diving,
accounting?
yeah, accounts. So, but
Okay.
I'm diving, right? I did it because I needed to be in university, and my parents wanted that in university, and accounting was like the easiest thing I could decide to do for 4 years, I guess. It's a good course, to be honest. Now, when I heard you say you're a teacher, HR, part of me feels like I should have done it. Because sometimes we have the notion that when you study education, you have to be a teacher. We never think about the other elements of education brings, what you learn in that program. And because I'm at a place where I'm always building something, like I'm always creating a curriculum, I'm always trying to make training material. And I'm like, I should have really done teaching. I should have done education. Like it's something I feel like I have a broader conversation. Like in Zambia, education automatically a teacher, and I don't know how it works in South Africa, but yeah, that's how it is here.
Okay, so because I also studied HR, how do I say this? You as a person, you should not limit your possibilities, or yeah, the possibilities in your life. And And what I realize as well is that in defining yourself, you should never limit yourself, right? I've been raising something very interesting just in my line of thinking to say, and I know this is a controversial point, but think about it this way, that how many countries have been led by accountants, right? And could it be that we are in this quagmire because we've been led by people that can't count? You see? So, and those that count shy away from, broader responsibilities around leadership, or are not seen necessarily as people that should be leading. But I think my argument has always been that I think that the whole issues of, philosophical thinking and all of that will always be there. But we must be careful that if we keep to the doctrines of 1940, 1960, and so on, imagine if that was technology, we would be using phones that were used 20 years ago. So we can't. We've got to evolve and actually evolve rapidly, even in our philosophical thinking. And therefore, we cannot box people, and you shouldn't box yourself. There's actually, I think, a competitive advantage because the other people that we've been led by lawyers, we've been led by trade unionists, we've been led by people that have studied philosophy and sociology and all sorts of things. And none of them have been able to achieve a double-digit GDP growth in the African continent, at least over 10 to 15 years. None.
I like that. I'm privileged to always have access to you. And for me, I'm always thinking that I'm not meant to be one thing in this lifetime that I'm living on Earth. So I think it in the terms of if for the next 10 to 15 years, I would love to build a business. I would like to build a business and have it very successful. Then, if after 10 years I go into, let's say, public leadership, I would actually like to transition and learn about myself. Because honestly, it's always the fact, it always starts from home. We're always taught that being a doctor is more prestigious than being this, being an accountant is more prestigious than owning a business. So when you look back to your life, how was your childhood?
It's an interesting one because when you talk to people that have studied philosophy, they've got interesting views about livelihood, because I've always used my own trajectory as an argument for demanding more from young people, right? And that is, encountering adversity when you are young, because I felt that that prepared me for the road ahead. And I would, with the benefit of hindsight, I don't look at it and sort of cry and all of that. I cried when I was young, because I thought, why this and why me and all of that. But looking back now, I realize I'm as tough as a nail, and thanks to those experiences, and I was just watching a video the other day, saying that there's research that's been done around what makes successful people. It's definitely the people that were not raised in artificial environments that are created through cash, right? So through cash, I can create an environment where you never get bullied as a parent, for example, because I'll fight your battles. I'll put you in that school where there's only three of you. I can even do homeschooling. I can do this. I can, and actually, that's actually destroying your potential slowly, right? So I do really celebrate, the my tears as a young person. I encountered adversity when I was young. The fact that elderly people can hate you, And that, you know, when you're being raised in a big family, you must not be naive and just think, you know, it can be lovey-dovey. That's not the case. And I think that was a big eye-opener for me. And actually, for me when I was young, to begin to question systems, you know. And that set me on a path of not just accepting things that I'm being told, because, you know, when you start being suspicious of adults, because adults I mean, represent a system for you when you grow up. And therefore, I just don't take things that people tell me. And fast forward, I go to university and I start failing some modules because I don't actually agree with the textbook, you know, because they're sitting here. Yeah, I mean, if you throw a concept at me, I interrogate it, you know, and if it's not well presented and you don't tell me the limitations of a concept, I'll tell you that no, these things don't make sense. I mean, in South Africa at the time, when I was at university, I remember being taught something about civilization, right? And the notion that moving from one civilization to the next, therefore the latest civilization is more superior than the previous. And I said, no, you can't say that, you know, because my argument was that the complexity of a society depends on the evolution of the challenges they confront. So if a society does not confront that complexity and therefore has not responded to it, you can therefore not say that it is inferior. You know, you can't say to a nation that has not experienced AIDS, it's primitive because they don't use condoms. You can't say that. You know, so yes, and then I failed. I failed history at university because I just refused that nuance. I said, no, this nuance is not correct. It cannot stand. And
Why do
then
you?
when I became a teacher, I refused to teach history because I said, no, I reject this notion of comparing societies, you know. I rejected it.
Why do you think that the system doesn't like to be questioned? Where do you think that comes from?
Yeah. That's a difficult one. Because I do think that there is sort of what we like to put out there as reasons. And especially when we've experienced rejection. But I think we need to probably think a little bit deeper than what appears on the surface, right? But on the surface, it's about privilege, it's about what people get, it's about insecurities, it's about all sorts of things. And I think that those who build systems obviously build them to benefit from systems. One of the things that I like to talk about is just a simple thing. I mean, in leadership development, right? I realize and I argue that leadership development is not looked at from the perspective of young people, you know? Leadership development is looked at from the perspective of older people. So it's about young people fitting in the doctrines that are defined by older people. And I'm saying, is that correct? And so similarly, in general, society is being controlled by those that are before you, you know, and therefore they protect their terrain. And therefore it's unconventional. I mean, I remember as in school and one of these RLC or student leaders questioning the behavior of teachers. And he was taken on the basis of being disrespectful. I said, yes, he's disrespectful in a social setting, but in a governance setting, as a leader of students, it's not disrespectful. It's questioning accountability. So, you know, and I mean, even now, he sees me as his mentor because I was the one that said, no, we've got to create space for this young person to speak to issues of accountability. You can't say simply because he's young, he cannot question you when you're not, doing what you're supposed to do simply on the basis that he's young. No, you can't do that. When we sit around the table and we talk governance and they are a stakeholder, therefore you got to deal with it at the basis of that the person is an equal stakeholder when we engage. And so Personally, I've never been threatened by that, but I've seen colleagues that are totally threatened. I was a hiring manager in one instance, and after doing a psychometric to the applicant, I was advised, no, you can't appoint this guy because he's got the same personality as you. He's wrong-headed and all of that. And I said, nonsense. I'm actually going to work with him for the very reason why you're telling me not to work with him,
To admit, my biggest challenges and opportunities, because every challenge is an opportunity, one way or another, is I love to question everything. I did that a lot when we were in South Africa for Yali, because if something doesn't sit well with me, I'd like to question leadership. I'd like you to create an atmosphere for us to engage and find a solution. And but overall, I've always been that child that would question the leadership in a home or anywhere, and question why things have to be a specific way, why divert. And like you're talking about the young leader that quoted to be disrespectful, I realized that leadership or the system doesn't like to be questioned or kept accountable. And they guilt trip us to say it's disrespect when we try to find answers to what we want to know. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's
Is it
protection of
disrespect?
terrains. It shouldn't be like that. And unfortunately, you're going to need a lot of people that are mad, to go into spaces of power and dismantle these things and make them possible, I have on a few occasions in my life handed over serious power to other people, right? And okay, I went on to regret it because it was misused. People they get the power and they misuse it and they steal and they do all sorts of things and you regret. But you see, you sit and you say, okay, what option did I have? I could have stayed in the role forever. What would have what would the world benefit if I'm the only one with this capability? What would the world benefit if the world never finds out that actually this guy's a thief? And that his eloquence when he's outside, the realm of power is simply to go in. He's using it to go in. It's not sincere. So sometimes you want these experiences. Yes, it's painful. It's painful, but I think out of these experiences, people learn. People learn. It takes time, but I've seen, for example, just the trajectory in South Africa in terms of that political maturity of electorate. That is quite refreshing when electorate is saying, no, but we like you and you're part of us, but you're not serving us. And you need that message, and you actually needed the painful experience for people to learn. Ideally, you would like to say, no, this is going to hurt. Let's avoid this path. But, we all have gone through the path. We've all cried, but we've come out of it wiser.
That makes more sense. Pain, we all need to go through some sort of struggle pain, to come out a little bit more wiser. I like that.
But here's the
And that's
problem.
why I,
Now,
yeah.
here's the problem. The problem is that, and I think that's where we all get nervous, is that some people don't go through the pain. The pain breaks them. So we must not be naive to that, when society talks about mental health and all those kind of things, is that there's a lot of people that are broken. They are broken, really broken. So I think the issue is that as you go through the pain, If there's 100 of you, there's probably five or six that go through. And I think that is the problem, you know? And the pain is necessary. But, you know, it can be devastating for a lot of people, and they just never get out of it. How many of your friends in primary school can you still count on today? You know, you look back and say, are they functioning at the level where you are? Are they in the spaces that you are? And you look back and you realize they were derailed.
Be honest, I think I'm alone. Unfortunately, now, okay, the good is that now most of those friends now are trying to reach out and saying, could you help me get into this space? What type of skills can you please help me this with this and that and that? What I realized is that I have been doing it for years. And they want it quick. Like they want, did the delayed gratification and they want it instant. They want to be able to qualify for YALI. They want to be able to qualify for these big, big things. And you might though, it's like there's a high possibility, but I got in because of my work from so many years and the different I took to be at this place. So yeah, I think that I'm dealing with a lot of instant gratification people. That is also frustrating on my end because I'm like, sure, you try it. I want to be supportive. And also know that it actually will take work. And if there's somebody who's been doing it for time compared to you, they'll probably pick that person over you and that's. So yeah. It's interesting to be honest.
Yeah, I think the other thing is the spaces that we create, right? And sometimes the spaces that we demand. You know, I always make the example that in social circles, when we converse about the work that we do, and people say, you know, I've got a cool job and so on and so on, and you say to them, what do you mean? You know? It speaks to not being held accountable at work, you know, as something that we value. Just giving that as an example, right? And actually not being held accountable at work is what I define as the basis for professional decay, right? So if you understand that the position you are in now unlocks your future, right? So you are actually destroying the position that you are in now, and therefore this position is not strong enough to unlock your future. I don't know if that makes sense.
It makes sense.
Okay. So there was a guy. I went to this gas station because I preferred to use it because he gave great customer service. And that one day he meets me in the hood, in the neighborhood, and he says to me, hey man, I think you kept on going to that gas station and you don't find me there anymore. I said, yes, I've been wondering what happened to you. You know? He says, no, I was at work and two gentlemen arrived and they said, we've got a job for you. And he said, no, I'm not looking for a job. I'm happy here. They said, no, we're going to make you an offer you cannot refuse, right?
Wow.
Yes, they took him into a field he's never been. They took him for training, right? And gave him a company car. And they said, in our business, that's the technical training that you need to work in our business, it's easy. We pay $1,000 and you get the skill. The problem is customer service. And they took a guy from a gas station and gave him technical skills in a field he never imagined. Because they said, all we wanted is your customer service. And I was like, wow.
Wow. That reminds me of something. So a few months back, I was invited at my former university to be a panel discussion. And on my last days, I had this come in and tell us about their business and the lack of enthusiasm. and just the attitude towards the whole display. And I was like, you know, sometimes people will buy stuff because they're enthusiastic about it and your attitude. And I say that all the time. I am told that best energy and I'm so enthusiastic about stuff, so I wake up every day, no matter what. And I get opportunities because of that. People want to be around me because of that. And I put that idea to that group to say, if you were just a little bit more enthusiastic about it, I would have supported you. It's not about the idea, it's how you present it. It's how you bring it up to us. And I feel like we lack that a lot, this the right attitude, the customer care, and the enthusiasm.
Yes, and I think it's more about not even how we project to other people. It's about how we treat ourselves, right? Yes, I mean, how seriously do you take yourself? That on its own, it's quite important. I mean, so the examples that the example that I shared about my views at the time when I was still young at university and arguing with a textbook and so on. It's about the fact that I wasn't just saying, but this is wrong. I was also saying, but this is what I think should be right, you know? So that ability to say, as you become a critic and you've got a critical mind, you also use that as a basis to drive innovation, to say, but this is the option, right? So that you are not consumed in the problem space.
Yeah.
In the criticism space, right?
Yeah.
Critique is about saying, I had a look at it and I think these are the weaknesses in what I'm seeing. And I think that these are the missing elements that if we were to add 1, 2, 3, then we'll have a better concept or a better situation. You know what I mean? So, and I think it takes a lot, I guess, to be able to make that transition quickly, to get yourself in a frame of mind where, yes, you see a problem, but you are also able to move into solution mode at the same time. Because also you got to understand that when you are in the problem space and you're seeing a problem all the time, you consume other people, right? The people that you want are the people that are excited about innovation and doing things differently, right? And to get those people into your space and open opportunities and possibilities, you've got to be able to say, I see a problem, but I also see a solution.
Yeah.
Yeah. And get into that space of contestation of ideas. And these are ideas of solving problems, right? And then you get people that will invest. Because remember, you studied accounting. Why do people buy a share? We buy a share not because of its past performance, right? We buy a share because of what we project as its future performance. When you buy as an angel investor into a startup, you buy into it because of what you think are the prospects of the future. And these are the people that are futuristic in their thinking and all of that that you want into your network. Because then the rest of the people, all they see are problems, you know? I remember the one guy leading towards elections the other year, and he was having a debate with me and criticizing people. I said, you know what? Let me just tell you something. I don't discuss people, one, right? And if you're going to insist on people, I think we must nominate you to become president. And he said, no, you're joking now. I mean, this is a serious debate. I said, I'm not, right? Because you're talking people. You're not talking issues and solutions. If you're talking people, then in your mind, everybody else will never be president. Then you must be president. And he took offense, right? But I realized that it's that inability to transition and not be stuck. And I hear a lot of people, they talk politics and they talk people, you know, and I'm like, yeah. The last point I wanted to make around trials and tribulations and how we learn from our mistakes and how we grow is the fact that somebody said to me that, are you aware that with some of the experiences that we go through, even if you are born with a certain level of intelligence and ingenuity and innovation and so on, over time, because you lose confidence, you also lose that capability. And that is why sometimes we question, for example, electoral patterns. You know, people talk about how the rural vote is such a critical thing in the African continent, and it changes the trajectory of where we potentially can go. Because when it comes, right, it is those people that really have been hit hard with hardship and everything else. And the voting pattern sits on patronage. You get a food parcel today and you vote in a specific way. You forget that for the past 5 years, this person never came to you. This person did nothing. But on the day they arrive with a food parcel, it changes your whole thinking. So it is that thing that I was talking about to say, yes, some people come out of it stronger, but some people come out of it broken.
Just while you're on that thought, I love Malcolm Gladwell. He writes amazing books. And he has his new book now, I think The Revenge of It, The Tipping Point. I've read the first portion of The Tipping Point. The Tipping Point is such an amazing book anyway. I won't dive into that. So for The Revenge of The Tipping Point, he made a short video where he talked about why it doesn't matter how smart you are, but your background and your environment matters, right? So he talks about all the factors you're talking about to say, if you're from a family that is rich, you have your own challenges, but because you have the system and structures that enable you to thrive, you will thrive. And if you are from a family that's not doing so well, let's just say poor, because everything, your mother works all the time, majority of the people from that background, because of different factors, not thrive. And it doesn't matter if you're very smart, but your environment is kind of like your enabler to your success or to how successful. We do know other people that have become very successful even from the environment they're from. But like he said, like majority of people stick to that environment. Like if you're poor, you remain poor. And if you're rich, you become more rich because of that one factor.
It's a systematic of you just get broken and broken because the narratives that emerge in those environments, it's really narratives of despair. You know, you rarely find anything that gives you hope, you know, I don't know what to say, you know.
No, it makes so much sense.
But what it then does is that it places so much obligation on those that rise to the top and manage systems, whether private business, whether government or NGOs, it places such a huge responsibility, you know. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, and we're talking about how there was a period of time where, so I was obviously a teacher and I was working in government and they were in private business, they were doing tenders and they were making millions, right? And we're talking about the fact that at that time, it never really mattered, you know, it never really mattered because doing business was not associated with glitz and glam. Yeah, it wasn't, you know, it was just the fact that this guy is a businessman and that's it. You know, it had nothing to do with Moët and champagnes and other things. It had nothing to do with it. And then fast forward, things changed, you know? And you sit there and you say, okay, things changed. And then what happened is everybody had an unsatiable appetite to do business and to be corrupt. When in fact, there was a time when people did business and there was no appetite. You didn't have to break the bank or do something to get into it because I remember the one time, and we were young, and we're talking about the fact that it was important for all of us to occupy different spaces and that we should not be going in the same space, all of us, right? And it made sense. But, you know, as you grow older, you look back and you realize that no. There is no way that I'm going to say to somebody that is young that don't start a business or you can do something else and you'll still be fine, because all you see is all those people that, you know, get into these spaces and they become wealthy by hook or crook and all of that. And then suddenly it's glamorous. And you're like, how did we get here? Where this illicit amassing of wealth is aspirational.
That's the
How?
thing, right? I
How can it
think
be
I
aspirational?
so to be honest, on Amiens, right? So it's
Yes.
so glamorous that most people that have the 9 to 5 are just struggling. Others don't even have jobs, and if you're being paid, you're really just being paid like the bare minimum. And
Yes.
for you to reach at a point in an organization where you're given a car, everything is paid and done for, it's probably going to take 5 to 10 years, right? And I
Yes.
also have my peers who decided to go into business, and a year later, they're doing so well. So, as a young person, I'm stuck between which do I choose? And what are the costs and benefits? And what is society telling me? Like, okay, I have chosen this business and I now know it's not glamorous. So when I look at people, I know that's a lie. Because we're all doing business and it's not that easy and it's not this and that and that. But looking from the outside, I like, I want to get into that because you guys look to be kicking it. So it's interesting to be in between and experiencing it.
Now, this is where this obligation I'm talking about comes from, and the seriousness of that obligation, because you know, people who are in power really have got an opportunity to can change the narrative. You know, like I always argue that you can be an accountant, right? In a growing economy, right? And I mean, you've done accounting. There's people that get a tender, right? For $1 million. But things don't always go according to plan. You know, operating costs spiral out of control and da 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 da. In the end, the net profit is exactly what somebody else that does a 9 to 5 ends.
Yes.
We forget about that.
Yes.
We forget about that. You know, so what I'm trying to say is, if you've got a growing economy that grows consistently over a long period of time, right? Some of this glamour is not actually glamorous, and we should be able to see that. Let me give you an example. What was the minimum wage when Trump said, "I want all American jobs back to America"? He was talking $19 per hour. How much is that? You understand what I'm saying? That's really good money. And people get surprised why Americans will vote for him. So these are the things that, and these things can happen in our countries, right? If you are able to get your macroeconomics right, over a long period of time, so that administration after administration, so you don't have the situation where the young one leader comes and gets the framework, and the other leader comes and destroys everything, starts from scratch. Another leader comes, destroys everything, starts from scratch. Because we are on a restart every 5 years. That's the problem, right? If we take a long-term view, And everyone says, you put in a foundation. Let me just come in and put in the walls and say, okay, you put in the walls. Let me just come in and put in the roof. Now that you've just put in the roof, let me come in and just do the tiling. Da, 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 da. We then finish the house. And that's all we need. And I don't care where you come from in terms of economic school of thought. I always say that, government will always be your biggest buyer of services and goods in any economy. And therefore, if there's prudence there, right, there's a good basis to grow and change the narrative for those that have been broken by their hardships. Because suddenly they'll be able to get a job. It'll be probably a permanent job that will enable them to access finance, because that what that does is then it also then grows your finance systems, right? So you are able to get cash from a risk perspective. People start buying financial products. You're selling loans. Suddenly your finance system, you're giving it a boost because there's confidence in the economy, right? Because if you're taking a loan, you probably want to build a house or whatever you want to do, but you can only do that when you've got confidence in the economy. And the whole economic system is confident that the trajectory in which we are going as a country, we're going to be in that trajectory for a long time. Then there's increased risk appetite. And it's all of these basic things, but at the end of the day, it impacts that guy that wakes up in the morning and goes on to a farm to work for somebody else to remove weeds from a farm for nothing.
That's so interesting. And you say this, but I would like us to also look at it in the context of household, right? Where our great grandparents started from is not where we're at. I remember when I was in my 12th grade, a lady came and said, "Always remember you're building on what your parents left, and your parents are building left, so your kids will be building on what left." And the truth is, one of our biggest challenges with our politicians and just African politics in general is the fact that instead of building on what the other person left, they enjoy tearing it down because they said they did rubbish. So it means every 5 years we have a new problem. We're tearing down, we have no foundation. So that's like our biggest challenge in Africa as it is.
No, precisely. Yeah, precisely. I think just that thing of, I can walk into any environment and I can just, take off from where you left off, we all want to be heroes, We all want to be heroes. We all want to say, when I got there, there was nothing, but there was something. There was something. There was a basis from which to build. And I've been in many situations where I've taken over from other people. Yes, you take over and they take it to greater heights, and you look back and you appreciate those people that appreciated the foundation that you set. They didn't come in and break it. And so why do you go into other spaces and break these things?
It's a good question. Like, why?
Yeah, why?
I also think it's a hero thing. And like I started, you want to be recognized as somebody that changed something. I don't know if I'm putting this, I don't know if you're getting my point. It's, I
Yeah,
want to go
but
in a
there's
bit.
power, but there's also power in maintenance.
Yes. Because
Yes.
it's not easy to maintain something you didn't start because you don't even have the
Yes.
vision.
Yes.
And it's so hard to pivot something and actually grow it than it is hard to start.
We've had that experience as a country where we've had power stations that all they needed was good maintenance. We didn't get maintenance right, and then we had to load shedding. Come in and maintain. Yes,
You're reminding me of something.
it
We really do have good infrastructure. They build roads, Beautiful buildings. Do you know one thing they suck at? Maintenance. They're
Just
so
come in and
good
they
at
say,
it.
you know.
They don't at all. And I'm
Yes,
like,
you can't even
no.
maintain the grass. Really? Can't maintain the grass. Grass has become very challenging in many countries.
I really enjoy being Africa. I remember when I was in South Africa, we visited Bantu with you, and you had like a panel discussion, and we're talking about Africa and technology. And you highlighted something very important. You talked about how there's so much opportunity in Africa because just inside of everything, they're reaching their peak at technology. As we're reaching the start, that this is when we are actually starting to actually integrate technology in our systems and truly use it. But still more because different factors, technology, it's a while before technology is reached in the rural areas and for it to just for them to experience it fully as we experiencing it in the urban area. Where do you see Africa in 10 years in terms of technology?
I think with the, something that's going on in South Africa now on the socials, I think there's not even a time to look at Africa in 10 years in terms of technology. You look at Africa in 10 years or in terms of spirituality and all those kind of things, because I think we need divine intervention, right? Because all our investment can just become nothing if we don't get this divine intervention that we desperately need, right? I'm saying these things because I don't think a lot of these things are rocket science. They're not rocket science. Create investors confidence at a macro policy level. Get people to have the confidence to invest and take risks. Okay. And then we all know there's critical infrastructure that you need for growth, right? So that's why for me, it's not about where will we be from a technology perspective, because to deploy that technology, right, you're going to need bridges, you're going to need roads, you're going to need this, you're going to need this, right? For that technology to be able to function, right? Because at the end of the day, when you create that technology is going to increase trade, for example, right? You're going to do transactions much faster. When you do transactions much faster, services must also move faster. So how am I going to do that consulting in the next town if there's no road, right? How am I going to send my goods into that town if there's no road? So it's technology is an enabler, right? But enabling what? If I deploy the technology, but I'm not going to be able to move goods and services, where am I going to get the revenue to maintain that technology? Yes, we're going to get tech and we're going to move. We're going to be doing transactions. You know, even if you do transactions in a village where you buy a chicken and all of those kind of things, but at the end of the day, the chicken must move from point A to point B before it gets rotten. If I had to slaughter it, because there is no refrigeration, there's no this, there are all of these things that happen. Because we got to understand that as we build this infrastructure, it's to enable business. And when you enable business, you've got the necessary revenue to do the maintenance on the technology and the infrastructure. Because this infrastructure, that's why we talk about white elephants, because we've created structures that are not enablers to doing business. It becomes a white elephant. You know, where South Africa plays failure for the World Cup, right? And now, if there are no games, where do you get the revenue to maintain the stadium? You've got to understand that it's not technology, it's everything.
be honest, I had this
It's everything, unfortunately. You can't de-link. So that's why you need this long-term strategy that says, okay, if the macroeconomics is right, I give investor confidence. You will spend your own life savings knowing that this, if I invest in this, this policy is not likely to change, right? For the next 20 years. So in the next 20 years, my payback on this initiative is in 10 years' time. So I'm only making profit after 10 years. So I can make the investment. But if I'm not sure what is likely to happen, will government, if government said they're going to build a bridge, are they going to build it? Are they going to spend 2 months building it or 15 years?
20.
Yes, that influences whether I'm going to make investment.
Yeah.
I mean, something that really broke my heart. I was in Madagascar and they say to me, yeah, we do have a port, but it's about 400 kilometers from the main city, Antananarivo.
Mm-hmm.
But there's actually not a good road network to get to the port. I'm like, I want to collapse and die.
This is not very funny, but yes. I actually relate. It's kind of funny. So my friends and I were talking. I had my friend on the podcast, and she were talking about climate change, right? How we need climate change policies. Our budgets just came out, and I think there's no, like, the amount taken to climate change initiative is like so minimal. And she told me to say, we can't start crying for climate change policies when we do not have schools and hospitals in rural areas, when we do not have roads. How do you then now get that money and invest in climate change when your people are hungry, when your people don't even have the basic to survive? And listening to you to speak about this, when it comes in terms of technology, it makes so sense to say, there's a yes. So even if we have this technology, which is an enabler, what are we going to use it for if there are no roads and buildings and the right infrastructure just for us to conduct business? That's so true.
Yeah, you get into a city and then there's narrow roads. Even the cars can move. You get into the city. I mean, I'm not mentioning these cities where you go to and the cars don't move. You know, you spend, what, an hour to do 15 kilometers. Somebody said to me, they go to this other country, and when they get to the main city, they go to the hotel, and they don't go out to visit their clients, right? They do business by getting the clients to come and visit him at the hotel. And he says, that way, I'm able to see more clients, because if I tried to get onto the road, I would only see one or two clients.
Ooh.
Because of road congestion. We can't do that. We can't do that.
So with that being said, what's your actual job as curriculum manager at Yali Center in South Africa? Apart
Please
from the
repeat
curriculum.
That. You said what's my?
Your actual job. Like, apart from, I don't know if you get the question, like, apart from creating the curriculum, what else does a curriculum manager, like, what else do you do in that position?
I think creating the curriculum is the easiest part. I think the most difficult part is, what do you want this curriculum to achieve?
Yeah.
And can it achieve it?
Yeah.
Yes. And like I always say to you guys, is the one thing that gives me sleepless nights is, how do you produce good leaders that don't steal? Where's the curriculum for that? In the continent. You know, they've got the power to sign these big checks and they will not steal. I don't know. That is the one thing that we desperately need. And I don't think that it is something that you solve through a curriculum. We're talking about systems. Yeah. We're talking about all of those kind of things. It's that whole ecosystem of accountability, of seeing people in handcuffs. It's a whole lot of things that needs to be in the ecosystem for these things to make sense. And like we say, you know, our hope is that the things that we do create so much passion, commitment in everybody else's heart, that one day when they are in power, they will be able to say, okay, I'm going to be that. Was it the president from Lithuania or so that still drives the VW Volkswagen or something of that nature? Yeah. And he still lives a humble life and People go up to him and say, "Can you please be president again?" You know, because people are nervous, right? You know, that's yeah. We live in a world where it's a long queue of people that are, you know, looking for an opportunity to steal, and to break others and to come even and all of that kind of things. You know, when I was an activist, one old man said to me, and we really wanted the change and this person to be fired and stuff like that. And this one old man said to me, "But Derek, we were sitting in a very high building. I think we were on the seventh floor or something like that. And where we were in that office, we could look through a very busy bus rank. And there were these big municipal bins for rubbish." And he asked me, and I said, "Okay, if we fire this guy, will you be happy?" I said, "Yes, that's what you must do." And he said to me, "And then you meet this guy 2 years down the line. You see that rubbish bin?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "If you meet this guy with his wife and children on that rubbish bin looking for food, and you know that you cost it, how would you feel?" And that changed my
Ooh,
life.
that's a good question.
Yes, that changed my life about how I look at being an activist, that actually you are advocating for change, you're not advocating for the destruction of people. Because that's something different. You're not at war.
Oh, lot of people hear that. Actually, as an activist, you're advocating for change, not the
Yes.
destruction of people. Derek, I'm gonna quote you on this. I'm writing
Yes.
it down,
Yes, and
and I'm gonna
that
quote
was, yeah, because I think somebody said to me something to me. I was about 9 or 10 years of age when I was growing up, and somehow I had this thing to say, you know, if my mother were to die, I would fish for food in rubbish bins, and so it hit home when he said that to me. It hit home, and I said, "No, I wouldn't like to see anybody looking for food in a rubbish bin." So, yes, I'm an activist, but I'm not advocating for destruction. I am not. I sincerely wish for change, that even those that are in leadership, I always say that, you know, and they say this guy's corrupt, and all I wish for is I just want to go to this person and ask them to say, "How do you steal, you know, $500 million? How? Because how many meals do you want out of this money?"
How many places can you
How
visit
many meals do you
to
want? How many pens? And how many, you know, because these are our essentials. So how do people steal this amount of money? What are you going to do with it?
That's a good question.
Yeah, what are you going to do with it? We can take out a calculator and calculate the average cost of what it will cost you and the 5 generations after you to survive. What is it that we need? What investment do we need today to be growing at 6% or 6% per annum over the next, you know, 50 or 100 or 200 years? We can do that calculation. Now, the question is, if that is the case, why do you then take the extra money?
A good question.
Why do I not take the extra money? That's my wish. I wish I could just get this opportunity to sit there with these people and ask them that question. Because it was not yours. I think it's different when you went and you worked for it and you made so much money. You made it. But when you go and steal it, then I have to ask that question to say, why?
And how does it make you feel to steal such money? How do you sleep good at
Yes.
night?
Yes. We've got situations in Africa where presidents are 90 years of age, they're struggling to walk, and still standing as candidates for election. Literally wants to die in office. Literally wants to die in office. You know, if they could bring the hospital into the office and operating
Would
from the
probably
office.
stay there, and we just don't know.
Now they fly to Switzerland and Singapore and
Yeah,
other countries.
because they built really not good hospitals in
Infrastructure.
their countries that now they go to other countries and call
Yeah.
our industry bad
Yeah.
that they built.
Yeah.
How? Like,
Yeah.
you literally went to that hospital and opened it. Now it's not good enough to treat you?
Now, the million-dollar question is, the new generation of leaders, are they going to be any different?
Yeah, that's a good question. In my opinion, there's a double standard to that. I think there's a double standard to that. And I actually experienced it when we were in South Africa. I was like, we are the next leaders and we behave like this.
Aha, you see? That's what keeps me awake at night.
And we're questioning the current system. So we question what we don't like in the system and we want what we like, but not right. Right? I don't know if that makes sense. Like you question, oh, we don't like that there's no seat at a table for a youth and everything. But we like that there's a way you can steal money. So you want to keep payment and publicly bash and say we're not. As young people not having a seat at the table, but you know that when you get the seat at the table, you want to get money and get the prestige and everything. So I think there's a double standard and we're not having an honest conversation about that. And I was at an event a few weeks back and everybody was talking about how there's no seat at the table for youths. Youth should sit at the table. I raised the question to say, do the youths you want at the table have the capacity, few seats to be at that table? That's my
Precisely.
million question. Is do you think we're ready for that table?
Yeah.
Can we
And I mean,
sustain ourselves?
if you took a public platform and you ask that question, you'll be criticized, you know. So it's a question you must never ask. You're politically incorrect. So yeah, you know, so but like I'm saying, you know, if we play a role in leadership development, and you want to develop leaders, these are the things that you really, really worry about. It's the trust deficit. And you know, I mean, when I was talking about the macroeconomic outlook and stuff like that, it's really about the trust. Do you trust that, you know, your government is going to manage the fiscus the way it says it will, you know? Will it be prudent? You know, the monies that are allocated, if a bridge costs $1 million, will they only pay $1 million or they're gonna pay six? If a firefighting truck costs so much, how much are they gonna pay for it? You know, it's all of these questions. And as soon as those things come, you know, it destroys the trust. And people say, yeah, but you know, there's corporate graft and corruption as well. I say, yes, there is. However, unfortunately, government is a leader. And not corporate. Government is the leader. They need to set the tone, right? And for everybody else to follow, because in any case, government has got the responsibility to go to corporate and say, you toe the line. Now, if government is not doing the right thing, you know, then there is no political will to then go and ring in corporate misconduct. So it's a problem, but I'm hoping, and that is what I was saying when you asked me that question about where do I see things in the next 10 years and so on. I says, we need divine intervention now. We need divine intervention, and precisely
I'm so
because look,
funny. Yeah.
the conversation we are having, I don't think there's anything spectacular that we are talking about, quite honestly.
No.
There isn't. So why is it that it's not happening?
Yeah.
Why is it that it's not happening? So, and that's where the call for divine intervention comes from, that I don't know, but I think we must pray a little bit more. I sometimes just say, you know, if you look at when it rains and the thunder and the lightning and all of that, God is so angry with us.
I have laughed so much. I think this is the one episode I have laughed from the beginning, ever since I to the
God is so angry with us. We must just get the economy right. And there's so many things you got to get right. And unfortunately, it's not complex things. And we can hopefully, I don't know. Look, one guy came to Yali the other day and he gave a speech. And the main message of his speech was just light the corner you are at. And probably if there's 1,000 people lighting their own corners, the whole world will have light. So you just try and make a difference where you are and just keep pushing, you know? It doesn't
That and
matter.
like the corner you're at, and if we all just take the ability to light up the corner you're at, then the world will be beautiful or will be light up. Like, I love that. That's my key takeaway. Light the corner you're at. No, I have a lot of key takeaways, by the way. Wrote them down. Derek, you have an opportunity to ask me a question.
Yes, this is the question I want to ask you. So, if you were in my role, what would you do differently?
It's a good question.
Having
I haven't
seen
thought
what you've seen, having looked at
about
all of these things, you said, young people say, we need a seat at the table. Are they ready? Da 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 da. And now you have got the privilege of being where I am. What would you do differently?
I would think part of the curriculum, adding the South African experience and learning more about the community. One of the things I realized and noticed so much was how it was about school much, and then play later. We never had a chance to really experience South Africa, and because of the different tracks, you can experience South Africa in your different capacities, right? So maybe there might be a funding issue on this, by the way, but having the different tracks go to different towns instead of
Okay,
us being
so how would you answer that question as a South African?
does the
Yes.
do not know how I can answer that as South African, so I'll pass. Yeah, so for
Look, no, I actually like what you're saying. At some point, we're actually just toying around with that particular idea of collapsing the program, doing a lot more online. And when people come into the center, we do a lot more site visits. Right?
because we learn more
So,
from the side.
yes, get more site visits on board. And yeah, I'm glad you're raising that because it was a preoccupation at some point, but as you say, things change. I mean, things happen and then priorities change, other external dynamics. I'm glad you're bringing me back to that. So I'm one person that thrives on people's suggestions.
Love
I harvest them for a living.
Yeah.
So yes, I quite like what you said. So from a partnerships perspective, at some point we're a very lean team and we didn't have the required resources to get just even those site visits were really a difficult thing to get together because there was just not enough people. But I do think that we're in a better state and we can refocus our energies on being able to find more site visits and actually do more site visits. So probably in maybe ne not next year, we that's that that the train is already off the station in terms of planning, so that's locked. But beyond 2025, it's something that I'll keep at the back of my mind and I'll push it so don't be surprised when other people tell you, oh, we've been to so many places. It'll be because of you.
Derek, I expect a call to say outside business, ne? Don't you want to come? Don't you
Yeah, for
want
sure. No, for sure. For sure. Most definitely.
come
So
and visit us.
Look, what we've done is we've
Fantastic.
tried, we've opened the, so historically the program was more academic, you know, there
Yeah.
were, yeah. And then over time, you know, we changed and there's more, you know, alumni on the program that are facilitating because we
Yeah.
see it as a peer learning space.
Yeah.
It's about how you've built your business. What can I learn from you? What can you learn from me? Rather than the textbook, you know, of this is how you study business, because that doesn't really work.
It doesn't.
If I sit in that class, I'll fail. I'll fail again because those things don't work. So we try and curate, although there's a theoretical framework,
Yeah.
but the content of it, we'd like it to be more practical. And that is where your site visit comes in. So if you increase that portion significantly, I think it'll be more powerful. So I really agree with you. And
I
I'm
think
glad that,
powerful.
you know,
Yeah.
this thing has been on the on the on a blind spot and you've just brought it back into the road.
It's the one thing I noticed.
Yeah.
I know,
No, thank
like
you
I'm
very
such
much.
an observer and
Yeah.
I'm not a class person. So I was like, okay, so we've been in class for
Yeah.
8 hours. This is a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? I have to admit, I love the peer-to-peer Tavo. And the alumni is just the questions and everything. I think that's something you're doing really well. I can't wait for me to be part of that circle, working
Yeah.
towards having a business thrive and being able to talk about it, talk about the steps and everything and the building process. So I really
Yeah.
love the PR part of everything.
Okay, the first thing you got to do is to set an appointment for early next year so that you do a master class on your experience of building a business.
I already sent you an appointment now.
Okay,
So,
good.
don't be
Great stuff.
surprised that we're talking after this. And your
Okay.
last question is, what do you look forward to as Derek?
I think it's a conflict in the sense that, like I said, I mean, I get the sense that I must always mentor other people,
Yeah.
but I know I've got passion for business. And building something, been experimenting with a lot of business concepts. And I think it's time for me to really, really give it a push. I love the idea of playing with the genetics, because I think that we've allowed you know, genetics to be imposed on us in terms of, you know, farming and that sort of thing. Because I think that, you know, there's always those goats that your grandparents had and all of that, you know, and what can be done there, you know, to make them commercially viable? You know, the chicken that your grandparents had, what can be done to make them commercially viable? And how do you create something out of that? You know what I mean? So that's where my mind is at, to be honest.
I love that. That's such a deep answer. And I loved it. And thank you so much for jumping onto this call and having this with me. I love this. Again, I have not loved as much. I did too. I have so many key takeaways and I really hope you enjoyed this episode and just recording with me.
No, thank you very much for the invitation. And yes, indeed. Yeah, I don't get to speak too often. I run away from speaking, and you got me.
Happy. I now know how to get you.
Yeah, that's why I was like, no, me? No.
I was just like, well, I prayed about it. So the spirits might have talked to you. I don't know how you came back to say yes, but I prayed about it. I was just like, Derek will say yes. I don't know how, but I hope he
Yeah,
says
because
yes.
yeah, for me, I enjoy it when young people are talking and I listen to them. And yeah,
But thank you
not
so
me.
much for sharing
Thank
your
you.
wealth of knowledge. I'm sure the young people also love. We enjoy hearing from you. Like you say, as such a man that's had to have access to. So if you have many alumni, they'll be so excited to now say, oh, Derek was on a podcast. Let me listen to this man again, because it's so hard to have access to you. And I hope you know that. It's hard to
No,
reach
thank you very much. No, thank you very much.
and for
That's
every
because I lead from behind, right?
yes, you'd lead from behind. Yes, so you had to spot, but a very important factor in the next generation of leaders. So thank you so
Akagandola,
much.
thank you very much.
Thank
Really
you.
appreciate the time. Cheers.
And for everybody listening into this conversation, I'm glad you made it to the end. I hope you laughed as much as we laughed and related to all our stories. Because I know, right? It's Africa. Same problems everywhere. So, guys, thank you so much and share this with a friend. And that's it for me now. Bye.
Just bye.